Well, thank you for your welcome. And what I'd like to... I had a very interesting chat with Edward here. He's a Baptist pastor from Evesham, about liturgy and about contemplative dimension of the life of the church. And it made me realize it would be good for us to have some more time for discussion than we did earlier. So what I'd like to do is to talk for a little about the contemplative dimension of the liturgy, what we mean by liturgy, worship. And then I'd like to invite you to taste a little bit of the meditation that I'll be talking about, because talking about it without practicing it is a bit like reading a cookery book without eating what you're reading about. So we'll have some time for meditation and then some time for conversation, I hope, afterwards. A few weeks ago, I was in Spain and I was visiting, I went to Barcelona to on my way to visit a very ancient and beautiful Benedictine monastery of Montserrat. And I arrived in Barcelona and had to spend the night in Barcelona. And I found myself that night on my way back to where I was staying, caught up in a what probably looked like a riot, but it was actually a football celebration. Barcelona had won some Spanish or European championship, and the city had exploded with pure joy. And it took me hours to get back to where I was staying, and I was just swept along by the euphoria and the celebration. And it was really delightful and exciting and beautiful, because there was no violence, there was no vandalism. People weren't even drunk, I think, but they were just happy. And celebrating in every way that they could. And there was no disorder, but there was a sort of a happy chaos. And that impression was still with me as I was leaving the next morning to go to Montserrat, to the monastery. The monastery is way up in the mountains. Very dramatic location. It's been there since I think the 8th century, and it's a monastery that has, although it's remote in one way, it's very much at the heart of the Catalan culture and people, because it resisted the fascist regime under Franco. It held to Catalan as a language when it was being oppressed. And so it's retained its place in the heart of the Catalan people in a way that the church in general, the Catholic Church in general, has not succeeded in doing, because it identified itself so much with the Franco regime. So I found myself moving from what you might call the liturgy of the streets, the worship of the streets, which was euphoric and ecstatic and blissful. It was really ecstatic. And there were some experiences, maybe in a rock concert or maybe in a football celebration, where you see ecstasy. The word ecstasy means literally to stand outside of yourself. There's a transcendence taking place, and you are lifted above the mundane, lifted above your sense of isolation, and lifted into some collective joy and transcendence. And then I found myself in the monastery and joining with the monks, my fellow monks, in their midday prayer. And it was beautiful in its own way as well, but it was much more serene, much more ordered and predictable. And it happens every day. It's been happening every day for 1300 years, and more or less the same format. So it was a very different kind of worship. But because it was so connected to the people, and there were thousands of not just tourists, but pilgrims visiting there, there was a sense of connection between that liturgy of the streets and the liturgy of the altar in the monastery. But then during my stay in the monastery, we did something else. We went higher than the monastery to the very top of one of the mountain ranges, where the hermitages of the monastery are found. And they have been there also for centuries. There are no actual hermits living there at the moment. But during the Franco years, subsequently, the hermits who were living there were living a solitary life, but like Christian hermits usually do, people came to visit them. And they became renowned figures. Their presence was felt throughout the country and on the streets of Barcelona as well as in the monastery itself. And when I went up to the top of to the hermitages, the view over the countryside and the plains from the mountaintop is phenomenal. Actually, if you want to see a picture of it, there's a book just been published called Moment of Christ by John Main, and the cover of the book was a picture I took from the top of the mountain there, with a rough hewn cross looking out over the countryside. And as I reflected on my experience of those days, I thought there was a kind of a symbolism in it of Christian prayer. There was in the Christian tradition, there are three liturgies, or three levels of prayer, three levels of worship. The first is described as the liturgy of the altar. So what we do when we go to church, when we sing hymns, when we celebrate the Mass, when we have the Eucharist, when we worship in whatever particular form of worship is we feel most comfortable with, or that is appropriate to that tradition or that occasion. So the liturgy or the worship of the altar. And then in the Christian tradition, there is the liturgy of heaven. There is the great cosmic praise, as we can hear going on outside there. It's probably the angels of heaven singing. And let's hope it's better than that. And the liturgy of heaven is the culmination of the idea of Christian prayer, where the whole of creation, the whole of cosmos, reaches its goal, reaches its fulfillment. And its fulfillment is to see God. The goal of the Christian life, the goal of human life, is contemplation, when we see contemplation as meaning the vision of God. St. Augustine said, the whole purpose of the Christian life is to restore to health the eye of the heart whereby God may be seen. That's why we celebrate the Eucharist, or celebrate, have our worship of the altar. That's why we read the Gospels. That's why we pray in all the different forms of prayer that we use. The purpose of it all is this ultimate goal of opening the eye of the heart, or restoring to health, he says. There needs to be some kind of therapy of the heart here, some kind of restitution of the full function of the heart, the deepest center of our perception, to be able to see God. And that's our goal. Now, the early, in pre-Christian times, this basic idea was also accepted, that the goal of human life was contemplation. But of course, a very few people were able even to consider that as a possibility. You had to be a very sophisticated type of person, a very elevated type of person. Your sophisticated life was built upon the backs of slaves who were providing you with the leisure and the comfort and the capacity for education that enabled you to set yourself aside, to develop yourself as a contemplative. And I think with the Christian consciousness, a new understanding of contemplation came into being, that it wasn't just a privilege for the few, and it was a universal call to contemplation, that Jesus is addressing all the people when he tells them to pray in the way that he teaches. And I'd like to look at what he says about prayer, because I think what he says about prayer has a direct impact upon how we think of worship. So as I reflected upon these three levels of worship, or these three levels of prayer, the liturgy of the streets, the football celebration, the more ordered and serene monastic life, and then the life of the hermits, I thought there must be a connection between these three dimensions of prayer, and they reflect aspects of our own experience, of our own journey, of that same process by which we restore the eye of the heart to health. Prayer is a great therapy. It's a healing. The early Christians used this metaphor of healing to describe the mission of Jesus. Jesus was a divine physician. He came to bring healing, not a judge to judge the world. And the Eucharist, for example, was called the medicine of immortality. So rather than the judicial, legalistic images that we've got used to with Christianity, being judged, being condemned, there was this sense of healing, that the Christian life was an acceptance of our brokenness, of our imperfection, but we were in touch with a healing power through the reality of the person of Jesus. And prayer is at the heart of this restoration to health. So what does Jesus say about prayer? And how do we put what he tells us into practice? Well, the heart of Jesus' teaching on prayer, you might say, is found in the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7 of St. Matthew's Gospel. And the first thing he tells us about prayer is beware of externals. He says, do not be like the hypocrites who like to stand on the street corners saying their prayers and receiving ego satisfaction from the way they perform these external rituals, either the way they are admired or looked at by other people, or the sense of self-satisfaction that the performance of external rituals can give us. They have had their reward, he says. So the first thing he tells us about prayer would make us almost suspect that he advises us not to pray in external forms at all. And yet we know that Jesus did. He was a religious person. He obeyed the law, except when the law was ridiculous, like not being able to heal on the Sabbath, and then he broke the law. But otherwise, he obeyed the law. He kept the rules, the religious rules. He worshipped in the temple. He attended the synagogue. And so he was a religious person. And yet, when he speaks about prayer, he doesn't speak about the external rituals or the rules or the regulations. He takes it for granted, probably, as a person of his time, that we would be religious. He perhaps could not have imagined a world in which we would call a secular society, but the kind of world that we live in today, where religion and spirituality have become separated, where many people say, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. Whether that distinction or that separation between religion and spirituality is valid, or whether it's even possible, is another question. We could perhaps come back to that later, hear each other reflect on that. It seems to me we can't really separate religion and spirituality. Religion without spirituality becomes empty, becomes even dangerous, becomes fanatical. We become obsessed with rules and regulations, or we become obsessed with our own rightness and other people being outside of our zone of rightness. And a spirituality that tries to be free of all doctrine or all dogma or all religion tends to create its own religious forms or its own self-generated religious structures. So I think that it isn't as easy as it might sound to separate religion and spirituality. That's a challenge for us living in a secular world where religious institutions have become largely undermined, or their authority has become undermined, and the majority of people don't even understand the language that religious people use. That's our problem to deal with. At the time in which Jesus was teaching, it wasn't a problem. A secular society was not a problem. But what we do see in the teaching of Jesus is a very clear emphasis upon a different aspect of the religious experience. He warns us against the dangers of seeking ego satisfaction through religious observance. When he does speak about prayer, he speaks about contemplation. Jesus is a teacher of contemplation. Just look at some of the points of his teaching. When you pray, go into your inner room, the inner space. Close the door and pray to your Father who is in that secret or that mysterious place. And there you will receive your reward. So the first element of his teaching on prayer is interiority. He then says, when you pray, do not go babbling on like the heathen, who think the more they say, the more likely they are to be heard. Because your Heavenly Father knows your needs before you ask. Very important statement for anyone interested in Christian worship. Do not go babbling on. And yet when we go to church, there is almost no interruption to the babbling. Might be beautiful babbling, could be eloquent or musical babbling, but there's no break from it. I remember a couple of years ago, at our monastery in London, going through all the Easter services, and I never wanted to go to a church again by the end of them all. It was just unbelievably unrelenting words, sometimes beautiful words, but you just can't take them all in. So it's so easy for us as religious people, lacking this contemplative dimension in our understanding of worship, to turn our times of worship or prayer, even private prayer, into endless babbling. And the babbling then begins to take on a kind of magical dimension. There's an important difference between magic and faith. The Christian life is a life of faith. A way of salvation, St. Paul says, that begins in faith and ends in faith. And yet it's very easy for us to confuse faith with a kind of white magic. And for our rituals or our external forms of worship to become forms of white magic. My mother's family come from Ireland. So when I was visiting one of my Irish relatives recently, I saw a little bit of this white magic at work. And I had lost my car keys as I was about to leave. So my cousin's wife said, "Don't worry, I'll pray to St. Anthony for you." St. Anthony, for Catholics, is the person who finds anything that's been lost. And it works, actually. But I said to her, "Well, you haven't got much time because I've got to leave very soon." So she said, "Don't worry, I'll offer him €5. So I said, "This really is a quick delivery job." And then with a twinkle in her eye, because she's not a silly woman, she said, "I'll offer him €10 because St. Anthony likes money." And I found the car keys very quickly. But as I was driving back to the airport, I thought, why did she say that? Why did she say St. Anthony likes money? because St. Anthony was a Franciscan. He didn't like money. Why should he be interested in money now? Now, the money that you give to St. Anthony is money well spent. It goes into the poor box in the church. St. Anthony is poor. So it goes to a good cause. But what I was interested in was why she was confusing St. Anthony with the love of money or the enjoyment of money. And I think the only explanation I can come up with is that this goes back to the way religion and culture mingled at a very early stage in our history, when Christians realized, when the church realized that they were not going to be able to eradicate pagan beliefs or customs completely. And they decide, you know, they realize that if you knock down one pagan temple, they would just build another one down the road. And they would continue praying to their pagan gods even after they were baptized. And so the only way that they could deal with it was to turn the pagan temples into churches and to turn the pagan gods into saints, which was very effective and very smart in terms of a cultural transformation or bringing religion and popular culture together. And the problem is that the Christianization of that culture may not have continued as far as it should have done. And so we can still find, and I think this is not only in the Catholic tradition, but I think in many forms of European Christianity, we can still find remnants or attitudes which are part of our pre-Christian heritage, still influencing our Christian ideas of worship. And I think when we look at the teaching of Jesus, we'll return to that now, we see a way of faith described in which there is a final end to the power of magic, even white magic. So Jesus tells us, we do not have to babble on, because thinking that the more we say, the more likely we are to be heard, getting God's attention, persuading God to listen to us, asking God to change his mind. We don't have to do that because God knows our needs before we ask. This is a radical insight into Christian prayer. He's not saying that we should not put our needs into words, or that we should not use words or beautiful music in our worship, but that the reason for doing it has to be rooted in faith rather than in magic. So this comes back to something I was saying earlier today, that when we come to worship or we come to prayer on our own or in a small group or in a large congregation, we are not trying to change external realities to find our lost car keys or to change the world in the way that we think it should be changed. But we are opening ourselves to be transformed. The first level of transformation, the first thing that has to be changed in the experience of Christian worship is ourselves, is the people who are doing the worshiping. Then Jesus goes on to say, when you pray, do not worry. Let go of your anxiety. Do not be preoccupied with your material or social needs. Now again, he's not saying that these needs don't exist, and it's not natural for us to be conscious of them. But at the time of prayer, we lay aside these worries and anxieties. Do not worry. Look at the birds of the air, the lilies of the field. Contemplate the beauty of God's creation and the beauty of your own nature. And this contemplation of the beauty and the goodness of your own nature will transform those preoccupations or that level of anxiety or obsessive sadness or worry. And then he tells us, when you pray, set your mind on God's kingdom before everything else and everything else will come to you in due course. Mindfulness, single-pointedness, being able to concentrate, to pay attention, to settle the mind, our attention, on a single point and to remain focused in that way. The essence of all prayer and of all worship is attention. We love what we pay attention to. We pay attention to what we love. Our human relationships teach us this every day. Are we paying attention to the person we love? Are we paying attention to the work that we're doing? And if we're not, then we get disconnected from it. So this quality of attention is equally true and valid in prayer. And Jesus tells us, be mindful of that presence of God. The kingdom of God is an experience of God's presence. The kingdom of God is not a place we're going to or a reward we get for being good, but it's an experience of God's presence which changes us the more deeply we enter into it, the more we allow it to surface and to become conscious. And finally, he tells us in this section of the Sermon on the Mount, be in the present moment. Don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow, each day, has problems enough of its own. Be in the present moment. So let's just have a quick review of those points, those bullet points of Jesus' teaching on prayer, and see what they add up to. First of all, a warning against externals or externalism in worship or in prayer. Then an emphasis upon interiority, going into the inner room. Then warning us against excessive use of words, pointing us towards silence, based upon trust that God knows what our needs are, and trusting that knowledge of God. Then a teaching on laying aside worry and anxiety, coming to a peacefulness and a calmness of mind, being mindful, single-pointed, not distracted, and finally, being here and now, being in the present moment. Now you put all those elements together and you have a perfect description of contemplation. This is what we mean by contemplation. Contemplation, according to Thomas Aquinas, is the simple enjoyment of the truth. The simple enjoyment of the truth. Doesn't sound very complicated. And we understand exactly what that means when you meditate with children. And you see the natural capacity of a child to be truthful. We know children tend to tell the truth, sometimes embarrassing their parents when they do so. And the capacity of the child to be simple, to be unself-conscious or uncomplicated in the way the child plays or relates to the world around it. So, here are the essential elements of Jesus' teaching on prayer. They point us towards the nature of contemplation, and they invite us to consider to what degree is my experience of prayer and the experience of prayer in my church, in my Sunday service, or in the way I pray with other people, wherever it may be, how consistent is my prayer, personal or community, with this teaching of Jesus? Now, after a talk, the first talk I gave here yesterday, somebody came up to me and they said, I've been trying to meditate for some time and I'm a little upset because some friends of mine who belong to a certain church are very worried about what I'm doing, and they're telling me that what I'm doing is really dangerous and that meditation is basically the work of the devil. And I don't hear that nearly as much now as perhaps 20 years ago when we were teaching meditation much more, earlier. And then in those days, quite often people would be concerned about, is this Christian? Is it really prayer? And I think Christians in all denominations, right across the spectrum, our own meditation community is very ecumenical, have simply been educated. I think we simply realize that there is a practical teaching on meditation that allows us to put that teaching of Jesus on prayer into practice, and thereby to develop a kind of worship, an attitude to prayer, which is consistent with the overall teaching of Jesus. In different ways, there are different styles of prayer, and different Christian denominations will have different emphasis on different forms of prayer. What's vital, I think, is that we learn to bring those different experiences of worship together into a common space, into a common experience of faith. I felt this strongly some time ago when I was attending a Dutch Reformed church Sunday service. I'd spoken in the morning to some of their congregation about meditation, and I stayed on for the worship. And I was really blown away, really, by it. I thought it was such a wonderful experience, because I'd never realized that hymn singing was prayer. It's the first time I ever realized it. And I heard the words of the hymns. I realized how beautiful they were, and how the singing of them was a real chewing of the word, a real experience of prayer, and an interiorizing through the music and through the collective singing. I really understood that form of prayer for the first time. And the way the scriptures were read and the way the homily was given, infinitely better than most of Catholic churches in the city at that time, I'm sure. And then it ended. After the sermon and some more hymn singing, that was it. No Eucharist. And as a Catholic, I missed the Eucharist as part of that whole experience of worship. And it seemed to me, what a wonderful thing if we could put the sacramental and the hymn singing and the good homily and the serious attitude towards the scriptures all together. And what a rich experience of worship that would be. How we can do that in the church of the future, I don't know. Because each of our different Christian denominations has such a high level of institutional ego, it's very difficult to really get them to penetrate each other, to share with each other, and to give of themselves to each other. And I think the only way I can imagine it happening is that each denomination, each of our Christian traditions, discovers the meaning of Jesus' words on prayer in its own way, in a new way. That we understand really, from our own perspective, what the contemplative dimension of Jesus' teaching is, and to really understand in what way he is a teacher of contemplation, and to put that to put that into practice in our own tradition, in our own forms of worship, and it will change the way you worship. It will enrich enrich those forms of prayer and worship. Meditation, for example, which is a practice, I'm not saying it's the only way, but it's certainly a very powerful way of putting this teaching of Jesus into work in our own lives. And it has an effect upon the way you read scripture, upon the way you want to worship with others. I can't predict how long that would take, or whether it will work, or in what ways it will work. But I could see the church of the future, the Christianity of the future, has to be renewed by a rediscovery of what contemplation means. And it's not from any particular tradition. It's from the teaching of Jesus, of the gospel itself. So let's just take a few moments of silence to... taste a little of what I've been talking about, and then we'll take some time for some sharing or discussion. Just a word about meditation itself. In meditation, we move, as it were, from the mind to the heart. We could also call meditation the prayer of the heart. It's an imageless way of prayer and a silent way of prayer. We let go of the operations of the mind, imagination, thought. We're not speaking to God at the time of meditation. We're not thinking about God. We are, in fact, as the early masters of prayer in the Christian tradition, when they spoke about contemplation, we are laying aside thoughts, even good thoughts. And we are able to do that in the faith that the Spirit of Christ lives in our hearts, that the essence of Christian prayer is our entry into the prayer of Jesus, praying, allowing Jesus to pray in us, and our entering into his prayer. That's why we let go of the thoughts, the words, and the images. And to do that, we can follow a very simple method, a very simple discipline of contemplative prayer, in which we take a single word, one prayer word, and staying with the same word throughout the time of the meditation, we repeat this word gently, faithfully, and attentively. And as we say the word, we let go of all the thoughts, the words, the plans, the memories, the anxieties, and the letting go of these is our entry into poverty of spirit, the first of the Beatitudes. So if you were to ask, what is the purpose of saying the word? The answer in a few words is to come to poverty of spirit, the first of the Beatitudes. So, let's just take a moment to sit upright. Meditation is an incarnational way of prayer, as any Christian form of prayer should be. And so the body is part of the process and the experience. So, Jesus tells us to stay awake and pray. So our body should be comfortable and collaborating with the experience, it should also be alert. Relax your shoulders, relax the muscles of your face, close your eyes lightly, and then silently, in your mind and in your heart, begin to say your word. And saying the word is the work that we do for the next few minutes. We'll just meditate for 5 minutes or so. Choosing the word is important because you want to stay with the same word all the way through the meditation and, in fact, from day to day, if you build meditation into your daily routine. This allows the word to take root in your heart, to open your to that liturgy of the heart, which is symbolized by those hermitages at the top of the mountain, which are still in touch with all the other levels of prayer and activity in our lives. So choosing the word, I would recommend the word Maranatha. It's a beautiful Christian prayer word or mantra because it's in the language that Jesus spoke, Aramaic. It means come Lord. And if you choose this word, say it as four syllables, Maranatha, Maranatha. Listen to the word as you say it. Give it your undivided attention. And when you get distracted, don't be discouraged or disappointed. We're meditating because we are distracted. Just come back humbly, like a child, and start saying the word again. It's as simple as that. Not easy, but simple. So take a moment to sit comfortably, close your eyes, and then silently in your heart begin to say your word. Maranatha. Maranatha. Let's end with these words of Jesus from the Gospel of John. Set your troubled hearts at rest and banish your fears. Peace is my parting gift to you. My own peace, such as the world cannot give. Set your troubled hearts at rest and banish your fears. I have spoken these words to you so that my joy may be in you and your joy may be complete. Good. So I think that was a good experience of bringing the Hermitage down to the football celebrations. So it was worth doing anyway, even if it wasn't the perfect conditions for meditation, because it does remind us, I think, that these different dimensions can and should be related to each other. Would anyone like to raise any questions or share any thoughts about this? Please. Sorry. Yes, you could hear everything going on around you. It didn't affect you. You could feel peace in the middle of it. Yes. You hadn't felt it before. Yes. Huh? Yes, usually you felt you had to have external silence if you were going to be quiet inside. I think that's a very good insight and a good fortunate experience, because it reminds us that, you know, silence isn't just about the absence of noise. It's certainly good to have a quiet environment, and, you know, normally one would try to get a quiet time and a quiet place for meditation. But the real silence is interior, and it's the essence of the silence is the quality of attention. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Sorry. Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes, the real problem is not the external noise, but the internal distractions. What do you got to do next Tuesday? And yes. Yes, I think that's the real problem of distractions. And if this way of meditation that I'm describing, that we practice just now, comes to us directly from the 4th century monk John Cassian, who was one of the fathers of the desert. This great, the beginning of Christian monasticism took place in the deserts of Egypt in the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries, and it was interesting that it was there that they developed this understanding of the problem of internal distraction. They'd gone out into the middle of the desert, they left their jobs in the noisy city, and they were sitting there under the stars in what you would think would be the ideal conditions for prayer, and they suddenly discovered, to their horror, that their minds were as noisy as the marketplace in Alexandria or in Cairo or wherever. So, and that's a very important first discovery, to realize that you are distracted. And I think a lot of people, we don't like to face it, just how distracted we are, and we run away from it. And the only way you can run away from it is by getting more distracted. We watch more television, we do more social networking, or more emails or something. So it's easy to distract yourself from distraction by becoming more distracted. But if you face the distraction, and I think that's what in our culture now, our level of distraction has become so intense. I was reading a book on distraction the other day, as a sort of psychological study of it. And there was one of their research projects was measuring how many times or how quickly people sitting at their desk at work would get distracted. I forget the numbers, like 36 times in an hour, say. You sit down at your computer to write a letter, and before within an hour you were distracted 36 times. But more than half of the distractions were self-generated. It wasn't that people phoned you or came into your room or interrupted you. It was you were sitting there writing the letter and you thought, oh, this is it now. What am I going to say here? And to deal with that, you say, oh, I'll just check my email. Or, oh, I've got to make a phone call. Or I'll go and have a cup of coffee. I'll do something else. So by the end of an hour, you haven't written the letter and you're saying, I never get any time to get my work done. So the study of distraction is very interesting. I mean, because of all the technology we've created to help us do our work more efficiently, we're actually distracted by that half the time. So then you have offices where they will have no telephone calls or no meetings, you know, for 2 hours of a day or something to help people concentrate. So I think in spiritual terms, facing that level of distraction, it can be quite embarrassing or quite frightening for some people. And that's why it's important, I think, to have a support group, you know, where learning to meditate within a community or within a tradition is much easier, much more helpful than trying to do it entirely on your own.